Welcome to the Workflow Show. I'm Merrill Davis alongside my co-host Nick Gold. We're starting our second season of the Workflow Show. This is episode 201, and today we have the special guest of Jeremy Stroopman, who is the East Territory Manager over at JB&A.
That's right.
JB&A.
That's right.
JB&A. So maybe we should start just by talking a little bit about what JB&A is and how we work with them at Chesapeake.
Well, and we've actually known Jeremy for longer than this. We knew him when he worked for Studio Network Solutions, makers of the SAN MP-driven SAN system. Was one of the first SANs that we got involved with. Jeremy was with them for a while. They're based out in St. Louis area in the Midwest, his home stomping grounds.
Correct.
And Jeremy now works with JB&A. This is a distributor that we work with. So as many of our listeners may know, we are a reseller integrator. There are manufacturers who make the hardware and software products that we deal with. Between often the manufacturers and ourselves is a distributor who has a lot of subject matter expertise in these various technologies. They warehouse a lot of the actual hardware products. They handle a lot of order processing. And JB&A is what I like to call a kind of a value-added distributor because they're very oriented around the pro media, pro video. They actually have a lot of digital signage solutions they do, IPTV solutions. And Jeremy kind of hopped over. Studio Network Solutions actually was getting distributed and still is distributed through JB&A.
That's right, yeah.
But you've made a hop from SNS to JB&A to work directly for them.
Skip and a jump.
Wow.
Over to JB&A.
All at once.
And when tall guys, skip, man, watch out, because they're going like 12 feet per stride.
It's comical, yeah.
You're like the Usain Bolt of...
it's like Harry and the Hendersons.
Yeah, we'll go with that instead. Because his name is Usain, not Hussein.
You know. So anyway, Jeremy's been dealing with a lot of the same kind of solutions that we deal with for many, many years. I've known you for, probably 7-8 years at least
seven
now?
7 or 8, yeah.
And so we still tolerate one another, I think, which speaks highly for both of us.
Volumes about both of these parties in the room, most definitely.
Right.
Yeah. So we thought, we'll talk a little bit about some of the particular products and technologies and companies that JB&A and you, Jeremy, are involved with. But, you've been dealing with many of the same type of customer scenarios that we deal with for many, many years now, and thought might be kind of fun to have a little bit more of just an open-ended discussion about our war stories, what we've seen evolving over the last 7-8 years as we've all been in this industry, your thoughts about that, your thoughts about a lot of the challenges that people are addressing, touch on areas that we've hit on in previous Workflow Show episodes, but also maybe with a little bit of an eye towards the future and where you see things going and the different types of environments that JB&A and your life as a rep for them, put you into. And
sure.
Maybe some interesting stories about funny, awesome clients you had to deal with over the years.
Well, yeah, I mean, as well as I do that the, a lot of our client base or a lot of the people we're working with are in emerging businesses, emerging production facilities, and they're really driving a lot of technology, and they don't necessarily always have the surroundings or the space from an infrastructure standpoint to put everything in. And it's not uncommon to see, a show that's really taking off, getting a lot of viewership, whether it's on, any sort of web-based distribution or even television, where you've got a bunch of editors huddled around a SAN or a big storage array all working. It's not always ideal, right? So, I've seen a lot of it out there. And going into war stories, I do recall an incident where we were working with a shared storage solution that was feeding the editor. It was actually in a proper machine room. It was feeding an editorial staff. And, it was around 7 o'clock every day. It would go down. And, it would reboot. And we would pull the logs. And we'd look through the logs. And we just couldn't seem to figure out why this thing was shutting off at the same time every day. And so finally it was, let's just get in the machine room and watch it. And it was literally the cleaning lady coming in.
I knew it.
Wait,
running
what
the
was
vacuum.
She, doing?
She was running the vacuum and she couldn't find an outlet. So she'd stick around.
Oh, and she would unplug
the SAN, plug the vacuum cleaner in. It would take about 10 minutes to vacuum that little section of the office space.
She'd plug it back in.
Plug it back in. It's one of those things that takes, like, you know, a month to figure out until you actually see it.
Right? Well, you know,
that's an easy fix.
But that does kind of speak to how a lot of this information technology has been kind of shoehorned into an environment that
right.
wasn't suffused with IT and IT practices. Probably
that's right.
that room should have been locked.
And that really sort of speaks to sort of the change that we've seen. There was a time when being an editor was strictly editorial. Being an editor meant being involved in the story production and the editorial creation. And then just about, we'll call it the Firewire Revolution, right?
Right.
The Firewire Revolution hit, and really it became a matter of having at least some kind of technical prowess before you make yourself insane. But these days, it really is a requisite to have a full understanding of a technical environment as it relates to editing. I mean, even if you're a single-seat editor and you're working in your own shop, I mean, you got to have that level of understanding. And that's reflected all the way to the top.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I totally agree with you. And you know, these people go to, you know, you go to school or your course on storytelling, and that's really what is covered, storytelling, how to tell a story inside of an editor, right? And then you get out in the real world, and it's like networking and IP
log these tapes now.
Why am I dropping frames, Johnny?
Log these tapes.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. And then, you know, now even, I think one of the biggest problems today is storage management and managing the content on storage.
Yeah,
and where
sure.
does it go? And you know, I think even 4 or 5 years ago, it was, you know, if we just get a big central repository where we can put everything.
That's great. That solves every problem we've ever had.
But yeah, throw everything on there and then we'll be set, right? And that's just not the case. Now we have lost things inside of the SAN because they're, you know, 64,
124. Everyone organizes things differently. Right. It's like tens, if not hundreds of terabytes all in one hard drive icon
right.
on your desktop. So it just exacerbates the lack of ability to enforce organizational practices amongst your work group.
And, that's right.
And part of that, I would have to say, has to do with how the current set of people are being prepared for the industry. We're working with a couple of EDUs, some universities. A lot of times they have something like Final Cut Server in there, which never fully implemented and never really integrated into their lesson plan. So the conversations that we're having now are, we need asset management as an overlay for our centralized storage for our classroom. And in addition to that, we need to expose them to some real asset management. The thing that's lacking, I see, and it's only now just to the uptick, is real media asset manager skill sets as it relates to a post-production workflow.
That's a great idea. I mean, yeah, absolutely.
It's its own expertise. I mean, I can probably count on one hand out of the dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of video clients that I've dealt with personally over the last 9-plus years at Chesapeake Systems. Scary that I've been here that long. But I could probably count on one hand how many organizations I've dealt with. And this even includes like mega corporations. We deal with some big media companies and we deal with some smaller ones and everyone in between. Maybe one hand, how many organizations have someone who in their job title or in even just their clearly established set of job responsibilities is the media organization and management tasks for the work group,
right?
Or the organization. I mean, literally weekly, I'll be in environments or having conversations where it's like, well, we all just kind of work together on this.
Right.
And that means like, so basically no one's in charge of that and it's probably not working out too well for you. Huh?
Right.
So, which, you know, again, I'm not trying to kind of insult our customer base because I think they're just the most charming darn people on the planet.
But it is an important
buy
consideration.
More.
it absolutely is an important
but yeah,
consideration.
You do yeah. need to kind of realize that that is such an essential task these days, whether you're kind of in the file system-based workflow or the MAM mm-hmm. database workflow. You do need someone or people of central authority who are kind of managing that system and the organizational principles that now everyone needs to adhere
yeah.
to.
I liken it to this, right? There's sort of the second AD to the production manager, right?
Yeah.
The post-production manager, rather. So you have your post-production manager, you know, he's dealing with the top-level fires. But you need that support person who understands the entire post-production workflow and understands the requisites of you know, ingesting all this video and asset tagging it and doing all that. You know, it's a really essential role. And as Nick said, I mean, like, there are very few people that are really dedicating the time to it. But that's probably where we're seeing the most growth. People are starting just now to open up their eyes and go, wait a second. You mean this 100 hours of television that I've shot that's going to turn into 1 hour?
Right.
And I want that one specific B-roll shot from that GoPro that was on the second set of pickups from the contractor camera person who worked only on Wednesday and Thursday.
Then this is kind of sounding like a personal story, Meryl.
Yeah, totally.
Well, you know, you draw from what you know. But so, you know, not knowing where that stuff is, I mean, can halt a production.
Yeah, it's getting better. I mean, it used to be, you know, a few years ago that it really took, it was somebody in the organization who had a passion for this. Somebody who's like, I organize data in my spare time, you know, and somebody
who is that person?
Me? I got that side to me. It's not my sexiest side, although I'll tell you that.
You should look at the desktop on my computer. It's like 4,000 icons, like all spattered around.
I'll go up and clean it here in a minute for you.
That's great. Yeah, exactly. That's great. He comes for podcasts. He stays for the cleaning. Right. Just don't unplug anything, please.
So when we, again, first met and you were with Studio Network Solutions, one of the things that made Studio Network Solutions unique is, number one, they had one of the very first SAN systems that was even kind of compatible with the Final Cut workflow.
Mm-hmm.
It was a volume locking SAN, and that you split it into multiple volumes and users
right.
could latch on to several at once, but only one person at a time can be attached to a volume over fiber channel, and then other people can read off of it, right?
Right.
And so you guys also really had that corner of the market for audio post-production for SAN technologies locked down, because for many, many, many years up until like now, that was the only SAN technology that was even compatible with Pro Tools. And I know you guys wired up a lot of very interesting studios.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You put SAN MP SAN systems into a lot of neat environments. Any interesting stories from back in the day about interesting scenarios you ended up in as you were doing that kind of work?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you're working kind of on the music side, I was in the music side of a lot of things in those days because it was the only Pro Tools solution out there, right? So I did find myself in great studios surrounded by legendary engineers and producers and things like that. So that was a lot of fun.
Snoop Lion?
not Snoop Lion, no. Did find myself in Daddy's house, P. Diddy's studio.
Oh, yeah.
I think the crown jewel, and I told this one time, Nick, was the Beastie Boys studio, which was Oscilloscope when MCA started kind of like acquiring movies at Sundance and doing distribution for them under the Oscilloscope name. They built a place in Tribeca that had, you know, half of it was the studio side and half of it was the business side of Oscilloscope, and that was just downright awesome.
Did you pull up in like a Mercury Grand Marquis really slow and just slide over your hood and just right. yell sabotage?
I slid down the subway stairs. That was
exactly.
about as cool as I got there.
You described it to me once as kind of basically like the ultimate clubhouse that you would imagine the Beastie Boys hanging out.
Yeah, it was very much like you would expect, you know. you know, VMA, like Moon Men and Grammys on top of the break room fridge kind of thing, you know.
Nice. You just use them to bust open a beer or something.
I don't know what they used them for. It didn't look like they were used for much of anything. But you know that was really cool. But yeah, I mean to that point, you know, that's where we started. We started out of a recording studio, Final Cut studio environment, and bought a SAN that didn't work because, to what the point you were making before, Meryl, those were IT assets that hadn't been pushed to the brink of production, right? And after, you know, when we purchased it, you know, it didn't work, and it was kind of one of those fix these or you're fired kind of things, and started hacking away on it and built it. And then, of course, because it was a commercial facility, we were getting the attention of other customers coming in to do work when they were in St. Louis.
That's right, because SNS really was an audio recording facility.
That's right, with some video capability as well, yeah. And so we had a lot of people in and out of that studio. They did a live radio broadcast from there. So there were some great names that came through there. And they, too, wanted that same functionality because you were able to bounce from room to room and just have and open up your session, right, without having to copy things or shuttle a drive around or what have you. So that's really was the start of it all.
You killed the sneaker net, man.
Killed the sneaker. Yeah.
So you guys started obviously getting more involved in the video side of things when you realized that this had direct applicability to video work groups.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There was clearly more of an opportunity to serve the content creation world and video and effects generation and things like that. And that led us to go outside of just that software layer, that volume locking software layer that you mentioned, CNMP, and got us into full turnkey solutions, server storage solutions, which of course is Evo.
Yeah, we have Evos out there in the field, and
it
basically combines the storage hardware, the SAN-MP software if you need to do volume locking SAN technology over either Fiber Channel or iSCSI, which is basically a block level protocol that goes over an Ethernet connection. And then it also acts as a file sharing server, so you can have that workflow going on as well. Now, there's some. Are you able to talk about some of the interesting things that are happening with the SAN-MP software and the evolution that's happening there?
Yeah, I think I can.
The evolution.
Well, if
punny today. If
the black suits don't start knocking at the door when I start talking about this, I think I can continue.
What's that weird little red light on your forehead?
So, share browser. Now, for the record, I wanted to call it universal browser, which of course would just translate to unibrowser. Yeah,
hilarious.
They're not taking my advice, my marketing advice on that.
Boo.
One.
I could just see the logo for it too.
I'll bet you can.
Like a baby with a unibrow and one tooth.
O in unibrow could be like an eyeball with just a line over it.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant.
Oh, that's actually not too bad.
So it kind of takes the SAN management layer level to a whole new level, right? So it does incorporate what was SAN-MP, but for all intents and purposes to the end user, to the editor, to whoever's connecting to the shared storage, that SAN-MP is going away, right? So it is, you still have your capability of doing volume locked volumes for locked up DPX image playout or locking for live ingest or live playback, locking a volume to a performance pool. But all other storage types, including the NAS protocols or the file sharing protocols in the Evo, are displayed. It will reach out and crawl around the network looking for other storage. So XSAN volumes would be displayed, StorNext volumes.
Really?
Yeah. So it's all showing
so
up
it's
in one
agnostic.
Page. It
let's,
really
let's
is.
Let's just think of these things as drives and less. It's not forcing you as a user as much to think of them as this type of volume, this kind of protocol.
Right.
So it's sort of removing that level of determination from the end user.
Like, yeah.
You don't have to necessarily know that you're connecting to a StorNext volume or you're connecting to like a standard file share.
That's correct.
If you just fire up the app and then search for the drives on the network.
That's right. A lot of that is abstracted by icons and naming conventions. You know, the Avid bin sharings, shares would pop up there, all of that. It also indexes the network, a light asset management type of a scenario where it'll index all of the storage, harvest metadata out of that storage, and place it in a SQL database on the Evo, right? So when the volume is removed, taken offline, or if it's not taken offline, you can go and search kind of like a finder on steroids kind of a thing.
Are we talking about customizable metadata fields so you can tag assets?
Not necessarily right now. We're really just looking at, let's scour all the files, mm-hmm. and you can leave out certain file names if you want, extract whole volumes if you want mm-hmm. from this, but you can set up a search or an index at any interval, and it just creates a database of all that stuff harvested that's naturally embedded in the file. So we're not talking customized metadata. We're not talking proxy generation.
But you could get
like
file creation dates. You could get the codec, the frame rate, the frame size,
that's
the
right.
wrapper. You
yep.
know. Cool. And you know, it really speaks to, I think, what we tell our clients all the time and have lots of conversations about and find, you know, some of our clients very much embracing, which is that, you know, this entire notion, I think, of media asset management isn't a product you buy. And
right.
media asset management isn't even like a particular technology, like, okay, we're using databases now. Media asset management is like the absolute top to bottom holistic approach you have to deal with how do you manage data and find the stuff you need to find. And what I like about this approach that the SNS guys seem to be taking here is that it's this idea of, well, we need to unify all of this stuff. It's not separate things. It's the storage systems, the searching for files, the metadata about the type of files. This
right.
is one thing. And yeah, there's different layers of it. Some of it's the drives and the networking, and some of it's the metadata, and some of it's the database. But you really have to take this holistic approach and think of it as
yeah.
one big system that all interrelates.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one thing that people do, or they're not necessarily setting out, they don't make a business decision, but they start by trying to manage all this content inside of Finder or Windows Explorer, right? Which is not what those tools were really designed
or
to do.
Or even their project files themselves,
right.
which are, you know, often extremely limited about, you know, the
what
level
kind
of organization they provide.
Yeah, yeah. And people are trying to manage them inside the NLE. People are trying to manage them on Google Docs and things like that. And it's just like, you know, you really need to think about what it is that drives that site. It would be as if you're running all of your accounting and all of your billing and all of that in, you know, like a notepad or something like that.
Sure.
It just doesn't...
I mean, that's a really, really great example, right? I think one of the things that most of our clients, at least initially, until obviously Nick or myself get in there and have the conversation and shed some light on the scenario, but the initial impression is that it is not something that should be invested in over time, or that it requires a good upfront investment. The way that we always talk about it is, well, there's more than just managing what you have now, right? So sometimes they have a hard time conceptualizing the fact that in 3 years of managing all your associated video data, you're going to have a robust and dynamic set of criteria to run searches against. And if you, for example, are generating reality docu television content, here's an excellent instance. Maybe you're in your second season even, right? Now, the value in investing in it all up front and spending the man hours to get it there is that when it comes time for you to do your season two recap and call back, and when you didn't get enough B-roll,
right.
and you still need that time lapse of the sun setting and the, you know, whatever, that you aren't sending four interns into a room with a revolver and a single bullet and asking them to go find the footage that you're looking for. You know, the idea is that...
although that could be its own very interesting reality.
Yeah.
Right.
Four interns and a revolver.
Four interns. Sorry. went into movie voice there.
But, you know, so...
It's nice.
The value is, okay, We're gonna invest in this, and we're gonna put the energy internally within our organization to do this, so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel every single time we have a requirement from network, when we have
right.
a requirement from standards and practices, when we have a requirement from an existing client that's come back. Maybe it was an industrial, maybe it was something for another business. So there's all these scenarios in which it makes more sense to know how to get to your stuff immediately. They're all hypotheticals. They may never happen, but you can say the same thing about, why do you have car insurance?
Right. Yeah, you know? That's true. I think if you look at how much money is being spent on going back in the past or losing things inside of storage or on the network or what have you, there's a serious ROI case to be built around each and every asset management discussion.
It's true. It's true. I mean, what are some, when you are thinking about and talking about ROI with prospective clients, folks you've worked with over the years, what are some of the main variables that you ask them to consider in that ROI equation as they're looking at an investment, whether it's in shared storage, a media asset management database, some kind of archive system? I mean, what are the things that you think media users need to calculate when looking at what they're going to, what value they'll derive out of making an investment in these types of technologies?
Yeah, I mean, I really think anything that can be automated, right? So anything, any automation tool that can be implemented inside of an organization. If you're spitting out five transcodes for five different mediums, moving those and delivering those to different sides of the, well, wherever they're being delivered, right? Same thing on the acquisition side, moving, renaming files, copying over here, over there. So many people just sit there at the desktop and move and copy files and things like that.
It's funny. We're in a creative industry here, and yet computers are very good at automating kind of boring, mundane, easily reproducible tasks. And in a creative industry that's all about very human, creative, narrative, storytelling kind of stuff, there's an inordinate amount of time, money, and energy spent on doing things through people that are very good at being automated by software and computers.
Yeah, that's right.
Just a transcode in general. I mean, like, somebody has a today has a Final Cut 7 workflow that requires, even though they're shooting on a better codec and better cameras, but, you know, they're tied to Final Cut 7 for the foreseeable future because of budget or whatever, right? So their workflow is to take everything, shoot everything. They got GoPros, they got 5Ds, they got Panasonics, they got everything in the mix, right? And the first thing that they do when they get back to the office is have somebody sit down, do the ingest, and then immediately do an Apple ProRes transcode, right?
That's right, yeah.
And, like, why didn't that happen automatically when someone just dragged those files on the set?
Right, a watch right. folder somewhere, and then
that's
just,
exactly right.
an action kicks off.
So what do you, what's the type of equation? So is should a business owner or the managers really be looking at this in terms of, well, this much time in this type of person's day in my organization is spent, you know, staring in front of a computer screen doing these kinds of tasks that seem like they should be somewhat automatable. We're spending X amount of dollars per hour on that person's salary or part-time. I mean, is it really just that basic
really,
an equation?
Yeah, it really boils down to that. And it's something I've worked, you know, prior to getting into media and entertainment or anything in terms of content creation, I was in the software business on the other side, kind of in the data center, right? And what I was responsible for is automation, testing automation, quality control automation on applications that were being developed. And the unfortunate fact is that I provided solutions that provided an ROI for people who were manually doing stuff. So unfortunately, it's one of those things where it's like, that body does not need to be in that chair. But that body could be somewhere else doing something more productive.
Well,
right?
And given that we're in the creative industry, it strikes me that, okay, if you are putting robots, essentially, which is what this automation software kind of can be summarized as.
I guess if we're, yeah, we stop beating around the bush.
Well, you know, so we basically replace some tasks with an organization by putting a software robot in that position instead of a human. We can better use the human resources towards mm-hmm. the creative tasks of narrative and storytelling and gathering great footage.
Or even asset management.
Right.
Oh, good call.
That's right.
Buddy.
Yeah, good call. Yeah. Well, in Nexidia is a good one in terms of ROI. So
what's Nexidia, Jeremy?
Well, let me tell you. Well, Nexidia is a dialogue search software, right? It is a server that scours through media, video and audio content, and creates a database of phonetic search capability, right? So it's not taking a speech and translating it to text. It's creating a database that allows you to phonetically search
of basically encapsulated sound fragments or phonemes, right?
Right, right. That's exactly right.
The
that's,
a, o, e, u, a.
All of that. So you can perform searches, right? And you don't have to spell it right. You don't have to, you know, it especially works in the world where you've got last names and words that are not a part of the English language or any language for that matter.
Strutman.
Exactly. So Webster doesn't know who Strutman is or what Strutman is.
Really? Because last time I opened up a dictionary and looked up Strutman,
it said it was a synonym
for awesome.
Ravishing good looks.
So you do a search. Are you saying the search? Are you typing the search?
No, you're typing the search into a browser, right? It's very much like you would on a YouTube or something like that.
But it's kind of phonetically deconstructing. So it's interpreting what you've entered textually and
right.
kind of understanding, ooh, the word S-T-R-O-O-T-M-A-N probably equals these types of sound fragments in
Correct.
Order. And then it does a, from what I've seen, extraordinarily fast, I mean, usually like a second or less, comparison to that string of what it's interpreted as sound fragments with its database of sound fragments.
Exactly.
And boom. But so it's not, as you said, speech to text.
No.
It's not going to generate a, frankly, not terribly accurate transcript.
No, not at all. But
so
what it is,
how would you use it then? You would have a script. You'd have a transcript. So say somebody shoots some documentary talking heads,
right?
And it's hours and hours and hours of it. And they got an intern and they've knocked out a transcript, which is basic. But you know the time code's wrong. You know it's just a disaster. You're never gonna not
or
pay
say
this intern
you don't even
nothing.
Have the transcript. I mean, again, you know you can use the Nexidia without anything, and you can,
right. You don't need a transcript.
So, okay.
In some cases, it might replace that.
Even needing to have a
transcriber.
So if you had like a really diligent field producer who took good notes while he was asking the questions and like had some key phrases that he keyed on after after she stated them, he would go back to the Nexidia dialogue search and he would say, "Well, you know, I know she said she really likes Sunny Side Up,
right?
Right? And so Sunny Side Up, bam! Oh, there's my Sunny Side Up clips. Okay, let's put them together.
That's exactly
that?
Right. So you're presented with a list." Of all your videos, whether it's, you know, 20,000 hours worth or 2 hours worth, right? All the video content comes back in all the different clips where Nexidia interpreted that word in there. And there, you can scale how loose or accurate Nexidia is. The most accurate results, you slide a little fader one way and it kind of narrows down the results.
And you might end up with someone being like, dude, that was a really good strudel, man.
That's exactly right.
Right.
Or all the other funny names you were calling me out in the hallway, right?
So, okay, and Nexidia, as I'll share, is obviously one of the pieces of software that JB&A is a distributor for. We're very friendly with them. It's very cool. But so you're saying a tool like that Nexidia dialogue search, okay, we may have, sorry guys, put some transcriptionists out of a job, or at least maybe diminished the amount of stuff that needs to be fully transcribed.
Right.
But we've now freed up individuals to spend their times doing some fun, creative searching of the actual audio dialogue itself.
Right.
To come up with some interesting storylines, maybe.
Well, not only that, but I mean, imagine if you had that capability 10 years into your archive, right? You have a member of your organization that has passed away or something like that, C-level executive or top-level executive, and you want to pull together...
All-time awesome Chesapeake employee Nick Gold has
passed away.
And
now we've created this montage of Nick's greatest moments or speeches on stage.
Oh, my
right?
God, I can't wait to see that. I mean, I don't want you to die, but, like, I can't wait to see what that video would be. It sounds like, you know, like Defending Your Life, who's like, let's see Big Bear. And then the screen comes down, and it's just like just the best hits of Nick.
Yep.
Hopefully we have at least another...
Next golden
years.
Moments.
Oh, I get it.
Right.
So, okay, this comes up all the time. What do we do about logging all of our archives? We've got 10,000 hours of finished projects, and you're telling me for this media asset management system, we need to have people filling out metadata fields for everything in order for this to be useful? Well, in that kind of circumstance, dialogue search could maybe stand in for metadata because it's not really... metadata that you're searching on, you're actually searching in the real audio data.
Right. But, I mean, the one thing it's not going to do is capture...
Like the category of something. It's not giving you the,
right.
you know, like...
So this is the sort of thing that you would use in tandem. with media asset management.
It absolutely
or it
is.
Could be it's a first tier to save some time, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. It's by no means is it the end-all be-all of asset management, but that coupled with your standard metadata. 2007 conference to top sellers, and you've got some guy doing a presentation, keynote presentation. That's the metadata. No one's saying that inside of that speech. Well, maybe at the beginning. Welcome to the 2007 Top Sellers Conference, right? But that's not being said multiple times. And if you're really retrieving that archive for some purpose, you're pulling that out of metadata. That's what you're watching. That's what you're looking at. But if you're trying to key in on a phrase or something that was said that was
touchdown.
I mean,
for sports video, yeah. I mean, every time, or goal!
Or, right. the phrase, the newest member of the Baltimore Ravens, Nicholas Gold.
That's a phrase that's probably not going to be spoken anytime soon. But and the other thing about Nick City is you can push those phonetic results back into a media asset management system
right.
as textual metadata, right?
Right, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely it does. So it takes your search, it takes all the time code-based markers where that word or phrase was said and can be exported into an asset manager, can be exported into Final Cut, Adobe Avid. You know, we were talking about it before. There's even Premiere Panel that's being built where the Nexidia engine will be right inside of Premiere. And that is cool.
Search all the video on my SAN for the phrase, Nick is the best, and boom.
Zero results.
No verbal K. I was just saying.
Wow, these are my friends.
negative one responses returned.
Okay. Anyway, you wouldn't even have to leave Premiere because they have this panel, like their own little interface within Premiere pretty soon is coming out.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, really, Adobe did a great job of opening up the API to Premiere, and you're really starting to see all the cool stuff that people can put right into Premiere.
One might say it's the premier example of an NLE developer opening up their APIs.
Oh.
One might.
We're
one
dorks.
Might.
Oh,
we're
ooh.
Dorks. So, let's talk about some other interesting things that you through JB&A are up to these days. We've been talking about Nexidia. We've talked about the Studio Network Solutions. You know, one of the other interesting ones that you guys are involved with, we're a newer partner of, is a MAM company, and everyone knows Chesapeake loves media asset management. And this one is called Imagen from mm-hmm. a company called Cambridge Imaging.
That's right.
What I noticed about it is Imagen, right off the bat, is not the same exact type of media asset management as a CatDV, a Cantimo portal, a Levels Beyond Reach engine in that, you know, there's a lot of high-level functionality associated with the post-production work group. Imagen's like on that other spectrum of MAM where it's like we want to create this large, very customizable looking portal into all of our video assets or, you know,
right.
present it out as a website that you can still do your metadata searching on. Yes, there's some workflows you can kick off, but it's actually like maybe something you would even open up to the public at large.
Right.
Or
yeah.
that you would, you know, you could use it to make your own stock footage site and completely customize the look and feel so it just looks like the rest of your website.
That's absolutely right. I mean, their approach, as you had said, there's almost two sides to asset management, one that's internal, one that's workflow related to a production group, and then there's the public facing one. And usually that production one feeds the public facing one.
Yeah, it's we've noticed some people want there to be one thing that solves all of these problems.
One
and
MAM to rule them all. I keep doing it, sorry.
It's great. You got a great like movie announcer voice, man. If you ever get fired from JB&A,
after this podcast, you should be maybe
can you help me work on my reel?
Yeah. Yeah, there usually aren't software solutions that cater to both sides of that MAM spectrum simultaneously
yeah.
100% well.
Right.
Some of it is pricing. Imagen doesn't price based on how many individual users have logins to the system.
No. No, because in a lot of cases it is meant to go to the wider public. You know,
I
way
mean,
outside
possibly
of
the public at large, or maybe
yes.
it's behind a little bit of a lock and key, but maybe instead of a dozen or several dozen users there could be hundreds of potential users, or thousands,
right,
or the public at large.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if you know, the three of us are three separate entities who are spending our advertising dollars at this post facility or this ad company, right? So they are creating a database of assets with separate usernames and passwords. Nick Goldco or Goldco, right, has a username and password, and Nick can log in and see all his different assets, but he can't see my assets as a different build customer.
So right? this is a mechanism, you know, and I see this oftentimes on production company websites. It's the login link, right?
Right. Yeah.
So they go in there and, okay, well, we've been hired and we've just done a 30-second spot for you for, I don't know why, KB Toys was the thing that came to mind. They don't even exist anymore.
God, I loved KB Toys, man.
So KB Toys, right?
I gave them so many dollars for Transformers when I was like,
I used to
hang
out in there like I would hang out in a coffee shop. But I do.
Across from the Suncoast.
And you'd like accidentally start walking down the pink aisle and be like, oh, no, I can't be seen down
there. So you say every mall from the Midwest to Baltimore are the same, right? Because that's exactly how it was.
Yeah, right across
later.
From the Suncoast. Yeah,
right, yeah.
Yeah, no question. But anyway, I digress. So we did this commercial for KB Toys in 2013. And we would, as executives of KB Toys Incorporated, would love very much to look at the finished rough cut, maybe.
Right. The spot, or a few different, maybe.
Yeah, maybe one that's, a couple color affected versions, you know, different scratch tracks, that sort of stuff. So they log in, they go, oh, six different versions. Okay, let's take a look at them. Right. I like number three. Do your job. Keep us in business.
Right.
Thank you.
Post a quick little comment. Feed that back to the production company. And maybe these aren't the type of executives who are going to want to like launch the full-on user interface of CatDV, Cantomo Portal, Reach Engine. Those are some fairly sophisticated post-production MAMs with lots of features and could maybe be overwhelming to a non-media professional user. But Imogen can be this gateway that lets anyone who can basically use YouTube search for video. I mean, it's kind of like a private YouTube.
It is a private. Yeah, exactly. And to your point before, I mean, say we're in here doing like here, we do, you know, Chesapeake came in and did this great renovation to this church to build offices, and you're digging in the basement and, oh, you come across this gigantic film archive and you want to monetize it, right? You want to be able to take that and post it to the web, either for the greater public, just to, some people are using Imogen in a way where they actually open up the for the greater public to enter
how
metadata.
How do you know about the Roswell films that we found
So you find the Roswell films in Chesapeake basement, and you say, I know that this happened somewhere in Roswell, right? But I don't know much. Right. I don't know much more than that. So you put it out on Imogen, and the greater public could come across it and say, oh, yeah, this was so-and-so person. This was that. And the public can actually enter metadata if you want.
There's quite an open source movement when it comes to things like Creative Commons and delivery of audio and video and written content. You know, there's the archive.org. There's just so many that I couldn't even care to list. This presents a unique opportunity for them as well, right? You know, if you are generating and acquiring content that's under a specific set of Creative Commons licenses and you want to then, with proper attribution, redistribute, this is an excellent platform, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the people who are using it now are gigantic sports archives, you know, IMG, the World War Museum in the UK. You know, those are huge archives that they found, and they're either making them available to the public or they're monetizing them.
Yep.
And that's the big thing, because video, we see it every day how cavalier we treat our assets in our video, right? But
let's make some money off of it.
Right. Yeah, 20 years from now.
Sounds like the mantra of hip-hop. We're so cavalier with our assets and video. Let's make some money off of this. Just feel like...
Call up the Beastie Boys, man.
Right?
We're going to cut a track. One of the things I really like about Imogen, and it is a newer relationship for us, but... one of their key U.S. staff members' name is Nick, so they're instantly awesome. Nick Ashwin. But plus, he's got a really cool Northern English accent, which kind of, Nick, I hope you're not listening, but reminds me a little bit of Bubbles on AbFab. It's very endearing.
Well, he lives in Dallas now, so I always like to...
It'll hybridize soon, you know. I
always introduce him, you know, excuse the accent, he's from Dallas. You know?
Exactly, right? But they're coming out with a cloud-based version of Imogen. Now, Imogen was typically something you would put on a server, and you're either opening up port 80 in your firewall to let the outside world in, or you're putting it outside your network's quote-unquote DMZ so outside traffic can hit it, or you're forcing people to VPN into your network so they can hit it. And that's if you want to host it yourself. But now you can put it in it's Microsoft's cloud service called Azure.
Right.
And you can basically pay a monthly fee to have your own cloud-based Imogen setup.
Right.
And, you know, X amount of storage of assets associated with it. And now it's just like in the cloud, on the interwebs.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about backup. You don't have to worry about all these things.
You don't have to
that's
build your own
done.
Web server. I mean, geez. Going back to what we were talking about before, you know, a lot of these people, these content creators, did not go to IT school, right?
So and they don't want to deal with opening up ports in their internal network for web traffic and
I'm
all
just
that.
A simple caveman. God. I don't understand these ports, right?
So standing up a web server is so, like, 2002. It's the place where we are now. It's so crazy, you know?
Right. It's all up in the cloud with the Care Bears, man.
Right, yeah. So, you know, a lot of people don't want to build out that infrastructure. So you're right, Nick. It's a very easy way for couple guys in a post facility or a couple guys who are shooting content to be able to get that up to the cloud.
And you can do your metadata tagging through the Imogen web interface.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can use it as the creative user, but then it also becomes the publishing platform. And if you have an in-house MAM and you want to open this sea of assets and metadata to a much larger audience, we can have workflows that publish from your internal kind of production MAM into that more widely facing, maybe cloud-hosted MAM like Imogen.
That's right.
It's
and
pretty
just,
cool.
Just with the metadata that really matters or is not proprietary or sensitive, right?
Yeah, maybe you don't want to have the note about, oh, the client was such a pain when we put this scene together. Like, you don't want to have that get published into the public MAM. You want to just have selected fields that are relevant to that class of users.
That's right, yeah.
So what other cool stuff you up to at JBNA distribution, or as we like to call them, Jabanda.
Or Jaba, if we're just really...
Jaba.
Yeah. Well, I've got a question, actually.
Sure.
You know, we talked a little bit about sort of where we came from. We alluded to the FireWire revolution. You know, things have changed significantly. In my perception, the next big wave here really is that native resolution workflow. You know, the 4K workflow and the 6K workflow. Of course, it's a lot in.
Don't forget the 5K, man.
Oh, let's not forget 5K.
A lot of red stuff's either like 5K, right? 4.5K.
Well, you know, like the red's got a 6K out, so like, you know, it's crazy business,
the
right?
The dragon sensor.
Yeah. So as we enter this.
Enter the dragon.
Yes, as we enter the dragon, very much like we saw the workflow significantly change with the introduction of FireWire. And then further with the introduction of FireWire 800, and certainly Thunderbolt has done a little bit for that, and we have fiber and 10 gigabit Ethernet always in the mix as viable options available today. What do you see as sort of the next big end game when it comes to a working natively with either 2.5K, 4K, 5K, 6K, whatever K as they keep on going up?
I know Sony's looking at 8K. They're starting to demo 8K systems in Japan.
If I could draw from history again, when HD was coming out...
Take us back in the time machine, Strutman.
Hop into my time machine. We're talking about time travel movies at lunch, and it was great.
1.21 gigawatts, Marley! Marley!
That's a very good Doc Brown right there, I have to say.
I probably am seen as about that sane on a day-to-day basis.
What did you just say? All I know is
me and Doc Brown like this, yo. I'm crossing my fingers here. You know, like we're tight.
So
is it gonna be like the scene where you and him, you're in the same room, you touch each other like it's
whoa.
I mean, like in Time Cop, where the two versions of the guy they touch each other.
That's what we were talking about.
Oh, you were talking about Time Cop.
You know, I said, you know, I hadn't seen Time Cop in like years, but I went back a few months ago and watched it, and I'm like, Okay, aside from the shirtless fight scene, which was a little awkward.
I mean, it's Jean-Claude Van Damme filled.
Right, yeah, it is. So you need that.
I mean, the man has.
But
pets.
I'm alone by myself in the dark, so I'm kind of like creeping
Maybe
myself
Maybe you should
out,
be watching a shirtless fight scene. Right.
But and so aside from that, and the horrible CGI thing that happens at the end, the amoeba that or whatever that
sure,
is.
Sure, it was awesome at the time.
It's that plot stands, man. It stands.
It does. And the thing about Time Cop really is that it's probably one of the only modern time travel movies that really takes into account being in the same place at the same time and causing a rip in fabric and time. Right?
Well, there was a little known film called Back to the Future that touched on that subject.
I've never seen it. Is it any good?
Who played in that? Oh, wait, we were just referring to it moments ago.
Nick is good friends with Doc Brown.
You're right.
Marty!
No, you're right. I love the I did. I love that movie. And you're right. The same person, same time kind of thing was a great concept.
But, so you watched this in HD, right?
So speaking of HD and going back in time.
Well, no. So the thing was, you know, obviously when I was a young boy on the farm selling sand solutions at Studio Network Solutions, that was the thing like, oh, we got to build these infrastructures for uncompressed HD. It's going to blow up. You know, what are we going to do? I only have Ethernet, da, 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 da. The software's accommodated for that, right? I mean, they accommodated for HD workflows to still enable great workflows inside of
Ethernet.
Well,
there was a lot of compression.
Right.
The software evolved to take better advantage of multi-core CPUs, GPUs, large amounts of RAM.
Exactly. And I think
64-bit RAM memory addressing.
Right. And I think that same thing is going to continue on. You know, we talk about 10 gig and we talk about 16 gig and all of that. And, oh, we'll need all that. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. But
when does it end?
When is it going to the chaos?
When they release the new Mac Pro.
Ooh. Oh, that's it?
No. Yeah, this is it.
It's
everybody
the
go
monolith.
Home.
There's a reason it looks like the monolith in 2001. Like, it's just going to end everything, man. Yeah. We'll suddenly start beating each other like orangutans with bones. Like.
But really, that's the first stone thrown in the new sort of era of 4K and above workflows is the way I see it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you're going to need all the processing power and all that to handle that. But I think it's more in the software and the processing and making sure the NLEs can handle this, native, yeah, all
sure.
the native codecs.
That means no longer using Final Cut 7, listeners. Final Cut 7 is done.
Should we tell them about the viruses that we've been putting on their computers that make Final Cut 7 stop working
in
another
2 weeks? It's called a 32-bit code base.
Right.
Oh, joy.
So
we do like harping on this, by the way. People, give up your Final Cut 7, please, for the love of God.
We can help you. It's okay.
Okay, that's enough berating of our paying customers for one day.
You guys are so mean. I really think that the Premiere and all of that, these guys they're keeping up with these codecs as they come along. And, you know, if not, there's going to be a plug-in or something. But I don't think we're going to need, you know, massive, huge infrastructures to work in 5K workflows.
I mean, it's
and
crazy.
I think the transcoding, the amount of transcoding.
We were just talking earlier about the new Mac Pro, not earlier as in like a minute ago in this conversation, but like an hour ago. And you didn't realize how physically small the new tower was.
No, you know, I glanced at pictures. I was kind of half watching the announcement and all that.
Half
and
watching Jean-Claude Van Damme's pulsating pectoral muscles in Time Cop.
In the dark. Don't forget that qualifier.
This is so true. Yeah, you're right. So I didn't realize how small it was, and we're looking at your...
You thought it was just like this large, giant black cylinder the size of the existing Mac Pro.
Like, I call the existing Mac Pro the scoliosis maker. I mean, like, there was many, many a time when somebody said to me, could you move the Mac Pro? And I'd be like...
There's going to be a workers' comp claim here, buddy.
Seriously, that thing's so freaking heavy.
Sharp, angry-looking box, isn't it?
Yeah. They really made the handles, like, painful, too. Couldn't they have put, like, a little rubber
razor blades on the side?
You could never have him at home with a child, because he'll run around the corner and hit his head on the thing.
Right,
you know?
Right. That's exactly
now,
right.
You know, the new Mac Pro from Apple will be childproof.
No, it's the size of the old Cube.
It's like a beer can, right?
Well, it's not that small.
A beer can you might drink.
Well, you know what it is? It's
I'm talking about the 2x4s I get in the 7-Eleven.
So
right?
You know how like some of the Japanese beer comes in the big cans?
The Sapporo,
the Sapporos.
And the steel can the that's just like rock.
So and okay, so think of that size.
Right.
And then you know how you can get the little like mini kegs of Heineken?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Imagine a cylinder that's right between those two sizes.
I can picture it now.
That's the new Mac Pro.
Let's go drinking.
You're speaking my language. Yeah, let's get a beer.
Okay, guys, beer time.
So if I gather from what you're saying is basically there's not going to be a total reinvention of the wheel here. Just like, as we feared, there might be a total reinvention of the wheel before. We have existing infrastructure. The things that we're doing now are changing the way in which we deal with the data and deal with the processes. But we can, just like there was a certain amount of overhead through Ethernet until all of a sudden there was a change in the way things were designed and there was more overhead in it. We'll see that come probably through the Thunderbolt 2 spec and through all that.
You know what also I'm sorry, go on.
Well, I the network infrastructure, the existing infrastructure, I don't think will wildly change. It's up to us.
Compressed 4K, compressed 8K is still probably a lot less of a data rate than uncompressed HD. And we solved that problem a long time ago.
Right, yeah. There was another big scare, like 2K is coming in a world, you know?
In a world ruled by 2K video.
David, are you going to take all the times he does that and cut it together in like a little string for us? That'd be great.
Nick and Meryl, friends torn by workflow.
We can use Nexidia dialogue search.
Right? You should take it. You put it all together. We'll make our own promo for the workflow show. That's great.
There was that same scare with the 2K, like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And then it was like, oh, lo and behold, 2K fits inside of this data spec, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think there's a lot of that going on. It's up to the asset management solutions, the transcoding solutions, and all of that. And the NLEs to natively play back.
You know what a lot of people don't realize? They don't realize that in the world of IT, hardware always seems to lead software.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point.
Hardware has always been ahead of software. We've always had more powerful hardware and all. And I mean, I started using computers since the Apple II era in like kindergarten. The hardware has always been several stages sometimes ahead of the software development. Just because Intel releases a new chip, or we've gone from 2 gigs of RAM to 64 gigs of RAM, or a graphics processor unit with 20 shaders and cores to a GPU with 1,000 cores, and oops, now you've got 2 GPUs, each with 1,000 cores, or you've got a CPU that has 12 cores, like the new Mac Pro one is going to top out at, that because of Intel hyperthreading acts like 24 cores. Okay, we've got this glorious hardware, but it took a number of years for the software developers to release products that could actually take advantage
of it. It's a really astute point.
And so we have like more resources already on our desks than we maybe realize. And we just, as you were saying, the software guys got to like just make sure they enable what's kind of sitting there.
Right.
And then we're going to be able to deal with that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, 10 gig has been around forever, and I don't know of a driver that utilizes it to its maximum potential. And it's just driver technology, you know?
At the risk of oversimplifying this, I mean, like, just think about it in terms of video games, right? What does a launch PlayStation 3 video game look like versus Last of Us or one of the games that's been in development for the last year and came out with the last 2 months?
Yeah, they always start getting crazy because they learn how to tweak it. Well, speaking of video games, there was some GameCube games. The Nintendo GameCube is what? How old now? A decade?
Yeah, and it had a Power PC chip in it.
There was Resident Evil, when the new Resident Evil games came out for it, they look better than a lot of games that are like coming out today on video games. Yeah. They just look glorious because the developers really learned how to utilize the hardware and just eke the last little ounce of performance out of it. It's like why we tell people that if you've got a Mac Pro or a laptop or even an iMac that was like released in the last 4 or 5 years and you're still using Final Cut 7, jeez, man, get Premiere Pro, get the latest version, convert over to it, and you're gonna like feel like you instantly inherited a computer that's like 4 times as fast.
You'll be able to utilize all your RAM.
Yeah.
For rendering time.
Processing
like
cores,
that,
GPU, all
those
things.
A lot of folks
things.
Don't realize, you know, you're going to invest in a new MacBook Pro Retina, you're going to max it out with RAM, and then you fire up Final Cut, and it's still taking its sweet-ass time. And the reason is that you're not taking advantage of what the hardware has to offer because the software itself is so old.
Well, you know, and the real-time effects that are happening in Avid and Premiere now, I mean, are amazing. Some of the stuff that they are doing in both latest Media Composer 7 and CS6, I mean, amazing stuff. And if you're not taking advantage of it, I mean, it's kind of a shame.
No, it's great. And then, you know, you throw something like Sapphire on top of that, and you really have like a really robust motion graphics pack that 5-6 years ago, you know,
you had to buy like a $250,000 flame system.
You got to render that stuff out, and you know, but it's all totally like usable and keyframeable, and you can fire it up within the interface of Premiere and just do what you got to do, right? And if you do have to render, you render it out. It takes some time, but not nearly as much as it does if you had, you know, the older stuff. So.
Right.
It's a brave new world, but I'm sure in another 6 years we're going to be sitting here going, God, do you remember when we had to still render our effects? You know, like I hope that's the case because,
right.
You know.
Well, given all of these years that we've been seeing all of these trends come together, you know, again, you sit as the interface in some ways between a lot of these very interesting cutting edge software and hardware development companies, the end users, the interesting integration folks like ourselves. Wax visionary for us, if you will, about, you know, again, what you think is going to be eating up all of our time in this industry over the next few years.
No pressure.
And you have to be 100% accurate.
And we will put you on the record.
In the future. What's exciting is the accessibility of content creation to more people who are creating it, right? I mean, more and more people are creating content with their phones. The inexpensive 2K cameras even now that are coming out that are actually within a budget for kids to get a hold of, right?
Gosh, we had the like Fisher Price Pixel Vision.
I mean, we just wanted so bad to like frame for frame redo Indiana Jones, right?
There was a kid who did that.
There was a bunch of kids who did that. Yeah. And it took like 20 years or something.
Something like that. Good for them.
So they're growing beards and then they go away.
Yeah. Great.
So the fact that people have access to that and the tools and the effects, the editing tools, the effects, the live broadcast switchers and things like that, and the ability to broadcast and actually have a forum through the internet is what's most exciting. And I think you'll see more and more and more and more of that.
And it's funny because that just echoes exactly what I tell a lot of people, where I think that video is going through this transformation right now where, you know, I relate it to like typing back in the 50s when you watch Mad Men. There was a professional class of people who typed documents. There was like, you got paid to do that. And it was like, someone's creating it and someone's consuming it. And much like with video where you had, and we will always have the very professional, highly polished video creators and then the consumers. But it's getting, you know, democratized. The access is getting just, you know, out in everybody's hands.
That's the other really exciting part.
It's becoming a communications medium that anyone can take part in.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Between iTunes and Netflix and all these other avenues, you know, we were talking about Breaking Bad. Like, I caught up to Breaking Bad through all these avenues. And before I even realized, oh, yeah, I actually subscribed to AMC, you know, and it's like, and there it is. It's on my TV, too, you know. So I have all these avenues to consume this great
show. I mean, imagine if we could go back in time, even like when I started working for Chesapeake 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And say, you can shoot an HD video on your cell phone, upload it to the internet wirelessly from almost anywhere you are within moments and put it in front of every single person on the planet with an internet connection, all in the span of like less than a minute. You could even do the editing with some effects on your cell phone.
Right.
Press a button. It's on YouTube. It's on Facebook. I mean, you wouldn't even believe it.
They would go to you, what the hell is YouTube and Facebook?
So that's the thing is people are now, like, it's actually like field packs for broadcast are going out there where it's like live on the scene, you know, channel whatever news are sending this up, not over satellite, but over load balancing across multiple cell phone towers from multiple providers to beam that content back to home base.
Right? And they don't have to like spend several billion dollars to launch a satellite.
Right. or crank that thing up to you know.
Yeah, the microwave. Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly. Well, it was a pleasure having you on today.
It was a pleasure being
here. I think we've informed and simultaneously alienated a huge number of our listeners.
But no, we really do appreciate you coming by. I mean, you're such an excellent resource to us. Our partnership with JB&A is so strong.
May we work closely with you for the next 8 years.
Yes.
Thank you so much, guys. It's always a pleasure. And again, love you guys and can't wait to see you again soon.
Can you just say, like, in your movie voice, like, thank you for listening to the Workflow Show?
Go for it. No pressure.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Workflow Show.
God, we're going to have you just as a guest to do that every episode
yeah.
from now on.
This is the most fun episode I've had ever.
Thank you, folks.
All right. You guys.